the optimal life.
So what I noticed about you is you're not just a licensed contractor. You're one of the first 50 certified LGBTQ plus business enterprises in construction. So talk to us about that. What does that mean exactly?
So there are a lot of LGBT individuals in the construction industry, but not a lot of representation of them. There's kind of a stigma. It's kind of an industry that's been late to adopt change. And we need change. We have 40% of our workforce is retiring in the next 5 years, and we don't have enough people to replace them. So an LGBT BE is saying, hey, I'm an LGBT owned company. I've gone through the process of approving that I'm both the owner and I manage the company. And it's kind of sad that nationwide, there's only 50 of us in the construction industry. And I say industry, I don't mean just contractors. That includes electricians, plumbers, maintenance, other companies like that. So really the number of certified contractors is even smaller. And so it's just a special process to get a designation to say, hey, we're out there and to tackle some of the economic challenges that we have sometimes.
Now, there's not special contracts that are able to be awarded for this type of, does it give you any kind of business edge? Because I look at some of the government contracts that are out there, service disabled, veteran owned, women owned, minority owned businesses. Is it kind of like that? Or is this just like, hey, we're a representation of this community and we're trying to bring some visibility to it?
A little bit of both. So on a federal level, we're not recognized. It's unfortunate, but we are not. We have a disparity of capital. We get let go from jobs still. This still happens every day. And on a federal level, we're not. On local levels, on regional levels, it depends on the state and the region. So the state of Florida does not recognize the certification, but the city of Tampa does. And it does count as a minority certificate in that same realm, just like any other minority certificate would take. Some companies have minority mandates. They're trying to spread the business around. And so while there may not be a federal mandate, say something like JP Morgan Chase has goals to do minority spend, and they count that towards the minority spend. But it's not required by law in the state of Florida, but it could be in some other states for them. So it's back and forth. It just depends.
Interesting. So how did you get involved in this line of work? What made you say, hey, I'm going to get into the renovation business?
Complete accident. Not a physical one, luckily. I have all my fingers still. I was actually a director of finance and accounting before I was in construction. And that was back in the Great Recession. The BP water spill, the oil spill had happened. I was in the hospitality industry. And I was one of the top paid individuals at a resort. And a drastic cut in revenue happened between the Depression and the spill happening on the west coast of Florida. And I got let go. Well, I got a call from somebody I'd worked for at a prior resort. And he says, hey, I'm with this new company. They're buying thousands of houses. They're renovating them. We've worked together before on the project management side. I'll teach you any construction you need to know, but I know you can get around and do this. Come work for me. So I did an interview. I came work for them, and I ended up project managing over thousands of houses here in Florida. And, you know, I've probably touched 3,000 projects in the last several years. Just in those few years and many more since then. And I just had an aptitude for project management. So it's a heavy communicator type skill. I'm pretty good at that. And I learned construction, got my own license and kept going.
What happens? You get thrown into it, Tommy. Hey, you're our new project manager. Here you go. Have at it, Tommy. Good luck.
Literally, there were three of us in the entire state. We didn't even have an office here. We were shipped iPads and laptops, not really much in the way of software. Here's the scope of work. Go meet the contractor and figure it out. We were literally renovating and closing houses without utilities. We would start to rent a house out without utilities. We'd turn it on. There'd be leaks and electrical issues because we couldn't test. That's how fast they were trying to get going. It really was. Figure it out.
just figure it out. So you get thrown into it. You have no formal training. You have no education on this stuff. I mean, there is no such thing, really. I mean, I'm sure there's maybe some, but not anything that's going to really get you ready for the real world. And you get into it. So as you're going through the days, weeks, and months, where are you stumbling? And what are you finding are things that you need to tweak as you're going along?
So, and I talk about this a little bit in my book, Building Success. You don't have to know everything. What you have to know is to be able to rely on the other people around you for their expertise. I can't come in and tell a drywall guy drywall this way. I really have to make sure that I'm using drywallers that know what they're doing. They should be way better at it than me. And I've worked with some guys that were doing drywall before I was born. They are experts at it. I can't come in and tell them. What I can do is help make sure that they have the supplies they need on time. Make sure that they're paid on time. Make sure the wages are fair compared to other bids. Make sure they're working well with other trades, because you'd be surprised. Electricians and plumbers don't get along. They're okay. They talk. But there's a contractor or a project manager needed to coordinate those efforts. It's kind of like a dance. You got to make sure it's well choreographed. So the biggest thing is listen to the experts around you. Don't be a know-it-all, because you're not going to be one. No construction professional is a know-it-all. I know a lot of general things, but I rely on the expertise of each specialty to really hone their craft and to educate me when I need to know something.
So for those that have no clue what we're talking about, tell us exactly what, when you say project manager, what are your roles and responsibilities, generally speaking, on any given project?
So for a project manager in that position, well, we hired contractors and we had to come in and help oversee the contractor and their subcontractors on site, which would involve writing a scope of work saying, this is what we want done to renovate the house to our standards. Here's the materials we want used, this type of light fixture, that color, this type of granite, that type of kitchen. And then we would ensure that they are meeting a timeline established. So if we awarded them a $30,000 job and we gave them 30 days to do it, we do progress walks to ensure that it looks like that they are moving along at an acceptable pace to meet our demand. Because ultimately on the investment side, we have to make sure those are renovated as much or as quickly as possible so that we can get tenants in to recover our investment. So in a typical project manager situation, that is working on the investment side from the contractor side. Say I wasn't the contractor and I was working for a contractor, it would be something very similar. Managing the sub-trades to ensure that the proper order of operations happens. You can't have the painter paint the house before you rewire the house because there's going to be a lot of drywall. So you have to follow the steps all the way back. What's going to be the most destructive? You get the most destructive thing out of the way, and then you start building yourself back up.
Where do project managers seem to struggle?
It's communication. It's emergency. There's a lot of sense of urgency and fires. And so what happens is you'll get a subcontractor calling you. I can't do this, and I'm going to be late on this job because XYZ is not done. Even though they had a week or multiple days to identify this problem and allow it to come to a solution, they decide to wait until the last moment. So it becomes a challenge.
Let me just interject real quick, Tommy.
Yeah.
So you get a call from a guy, the guy's running a week or two behind. And now that's going to screw up the rest of the schedule. Because you can't have your painter, you can't have your painter ready to go if the drywall's not in yet.
So, that's exactly right.
Right.
It's a dance. It really is. It's an intricate type thing. So we have to make sure that the plumber scheduled maybe 2 weeks ahead. Well, the countertops and sink has to go in first, right? So if the countertops are late, if the granite is late being installed, it has now delayed the plumber. And it may be another 2 weeks before you can get the plumber back, depending on what's going on. So it's very imperative to communicate why you need to be done on time, not just be done on this date. But if you're not done on this time, you're going to back up this entire project. And quite frankly, it could back up your pay. Because if I'm not getting paid because you delay the project, then you're not getting paid because the project's delayed. And sometimes that is the case. And that usually motivates people if they understand why not just get it done.
But how about the times where the person is not understanding or is being difficult? And I assume that there's been plenty of times still where you have to part ways with a sub halfway through a project. And if you do have had to do that, how do you pivot and ensure like, hey, we got to replace this person and still do it at the right cost?
Well, it's a funny thing. There's a line in my book, and it's one of my favorite, and it's my pen is bigger. And the reason I say that is because ultimately I am the boss and I do sign the check. That doesn't mean I come in and wave it around and say, you get this done because I'm the boss. I never do that unless it's at the very end, unless they're trying to say, well, we can't do it or we're not going to do it. Ultimately, I have to move a project forward. And I hate to lose subcontractors, but occasionally you have to. You have to say, you know what? You're causing me more problems than you are work. It's not working out. And if I'm already late on this project, letting you go is not going to change that. So now, since you're not going to pick up the pace, we have to let you go and part ways. And a lot of times they'll come back and say, I'm sorry. no, we're way past that. We've given you so many chances. We try to be amicable. I don't yell. I'm not a Gordon Ramsay. I'm not going to come in and flip a table and throw a pot at your head. It's I respect what they're saying, but at the end of the day, I communicate what I am obligated to fulfill for my clients. I have to fulfill that. That means you have to fulfill your obligations to me so I can fulfill my obligations to them, or we all lose work.
How many projects can one person take on at once?
That varies depending on the project manager and the assistance level. I've personally taken on 20 or 30 renovations at a single time myself without assistant level. We can take on more with more assistance, or it depends on the complexity of the project. Small work orders are easier to do, even larger than that. Large scale renovations where they're running well into the six figures, you have to do less. I like to try to keep it around 10 for my director of construction. And then I also supplement myself by stepping in and helping in various stages. So maybe permitting is not as much on the project manager as it is on a technician before then, which takes load off. Calling inspections the same way, that can be delegated. And then we'll have assistant project managers step in to assist with smaller things where you just need to meet an inspector to answer a question. It takes a little bit of the project manager's time off, and it doesn't need the highest level of skill or quality, just needs somebody there to answer basics. So it really does vary on the type of the project.
Sure. Well, that makes sense. When it comes to things that you really enjoy about this line of work, obviously dealing with the personalities could be tricky. And we talked about that, and guys running behind, that's got to be probably one of the biggest pain points. But there's got to be something really rewarding too when a project, you start with a something that looks like, we'll call it garbage, and ends up looking like a beautiful, pristine castle at the end of the project. That has to be tremendously fulfilling.
It is. And I talk about this a little bit in my book. I tell everybody when they first meet with me, they're going to love me. You're going to, oh, this is great. And then I say, you're going to hate me during this project at some point. It's like a sandwich with the meat in the center, the bread you love, the meat you didn't, or, you know, just kind of going that way. But there's going to be a point where you hate me. Oh, no, we're not. And I'm like, no, we're coming in to destroy your kitchen for 3 to 6 months. I said, you're going to hate me. It's not me that you hate. It's you hate the inconvenience and intrusion. But the amazement on their face. I had a set of clients, retired, hurricane destroyed their house, 5 months to even get a check from insurance. They're running out of funds just to live on. And they got angry at me. It wasn't my fault. I can't control the insurance schedule. We're documenting and giving everything there. But fast forward, more than a year later, we get them back into their house. And it's a whole new, oh my God, sit down, Tommy. Oh, we love this. It's a new house and this is great. And we're so happy. And they forget all the pain points. They forget all that bad spots there. And they come back to love you again because they're happy with that new polished castle, like you said.
And then, of course, they're going and telling their friends and family about Tommy and his company. I would imagine word of mouth referrals are probably the most important thing for your business.
They're very, very important. So we like to feature our clients or projects when we can online. We ask for reviews. That's always important. And not enough people in any industry ask for reviews so that you can go and see. Your house just flooded? Go and look at my profile and you can see somebody that just flooded that said, hey, they did a great job. They come in and fixed my house and got me back. But that word of mouth, it's critical because people get their recommendations from Facebook now. They don't just Google all the time. They look at your local, think about how many local groups you're probably on your Facebook, yard sale, buy here, sell there, what's happening. Those referrals count.
Absolutely. I imagine that show, what was that show? Extreme Home Makeover. Was that Ty? Who was that guy? Ty Pennington or whatever his name was years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I am like a middle-aged man yelling at a football screen like I should be the referee when I see Home and Garden television come on. It's all scripted and all fake. So literally, I will not watch HGTV because of that. And if it comes on like in a waiting room, I have to look away because I will become large and angry. And I am not a large or angry person.
What don't you like about what are they glamorizing or what are they making that's unrealistic? What is it?
We're gonna make over this kitchen in just 2 days. We're gonna get in and out and make this new dream home for this family and just whatever. They completely ignore the 6 month of permitting process. They completely ignore all the stuff that happens behind the drywall. And that's a chapter in my book.
And then your clients are going, hey, I watched this show. It took them a week to get their house renovated.
Yeah, it took them a week. Why can't you get it done? Exactly. Yeah. That comes to us. And so there's perception. Oh, we're going to be moving in 3 weeks. So we want to have our complete kitchen renovated. Could you just have that done before we move in? No, you can't get a permit in 3 weeks. What do you mean a permit? You don't need a permit. Yes. Yes, we do need a permit because my license is on the line and we permit our work. That is a requirement by our local governments. So yeah, they have this misconception. So that's, it's like a huge, huge problem that we face. And so then when you answer that question, somebody's like, well, why can't you get it done? Other people get it done. No, no. All the other contractors have these same problems, the same permitting, the same materials. They have all the same thing. It's just, we're pretty upfront about it and say, this is what you're going to expect.
I got to tell you, you've been doing this for how long now?
Construction, about 12 years.
12 years. And you're sitting here today, you've got a book, you've got a thriving company and business, and it's got to be pretty astonishing for you to take a step back in times like this and look back and being, wow, I was once in poverty.
Yeah, it really has been because, you know, I sit on the board of directors of the Tampa Club. It's on the 42nd floor, the tallest building in the city of Tampa. It's a very exclusive business club. And I grew up in a mobile home, pretty poor. You know, I wasn't given, like, I didn't have parents that could pay for my college education. I didn't have special opportunities to get internships. I didn't have this. I had to go out and find them myself. I had to fail a lot to get to where I'm at today as well. And then learning that term to fail forward is something that I'm very, very familiar with to get. But it is humbling. But, you know, I stand up. I recently got a custom suit, hand-tailored suit. I don't say that to brag. I say that because my very first suit was a Goodwill special, a blue suit with plastic gold buttons on it. And it was really fancy to me because that's the first time I had it and where I've come today. So especially when I'm talking to people that have been down on their luck, I've been there. And really, really to children. Hey, you didn't have the best life growing up, neither did I. There was a lot of problems. And I talk about those, some of them in my book, but there was a lot of problems, but look where I got. I didn't have people pity me. I just got there.
What were some of the problems, whether the ones either highlighted in the book or some that come to mind from your childhood that stuck with you?
Well, I had some parents that kind of always thought, oh, work for this company for 30 years and they'll take care of you. And that's not true. There is no such thing as a pension anymore. Sometimes I would have parents that would say, oh, we're just down and this is just the way it always is because you can't get ahead. And it was a lot of self-blame because instead of taking responsibility with, okay, this is the way it is, but what can we do to change it? They just keep repeating the same mistakes. And that's one of the hardest things in anybody's life is you think it's not going to work, but what you're doing doesn't work now. So what's the harm in trying something different? Maybe it's uncomfortable. Maybe you don't like it. But why replicate what you're doing? Because it's going to get you the same results. It's literally the definition of insanity.
Sure. Do you remember, I would assume some of your friends, while they may have also lived in mobile homes, I assume a lot of them didn't. So
some did. It was kind of cool. So when I was in elementary school, I went to a really poor school. We were all poor. It was all just kind of normal. When I went to middle school, I went to a special charter school. It was one of the first in the state of Florida. And it's a public school, but ran like a private school. So there's no tuition. But they had technology. You know, we had up-to-date technology. We had field trips. We had a lot of cool things that we didn't have in elementary school. That's the first time, you know, I kind of realized, hey, I didn't have any money. I mean, there's a chapter in my book, the very first one, my backpack told me I was poor. You know, I didn't realize until I didn't have the nicest shoes, the nicest backpack, the nicest lunchbox around all these other kids that many of them maybe were just middle class, but several of them, like one of them lived in a $1 million mansion. I didn't realize how poor I was until I saw the rest of society, all these other kids. And it was very humbling. It's very strange, actually.
Yeah. The middle school is when you don't know any different, that's just life. You're happy. And then you all of a sudden get thrown into a mix of being exposed to other things and people that might have a better situation. And you're going, wait a second. Not everyone lives like this in the mobile. Mm-hmm. And then you're looking at the kids' clothes and their book bags and their whatever, their tennis shoes. And realizing, holy cow, these kids are so much luckier than me. That's when the mental stuff starts seeping in.
It really does. Like there was one kid, they had annual passes to Disney ever since they were little. I'd only been to Disney like once. And so just like, they're like, we don't want to go to Disney this weekend. Our parents are making us go. I'm like, making you go? It's like been once. There's just little things like that that these kids took for granted. They didn't realize. And there was nothing wrong with them. They didn't do anything wrong. It's nothing against their parents. Their parents worked and they got there. But it was very strange to just like even a car with a working air conditioner. We didn't always have a working air conditioner in our car, if we had a working car. So the kids are like pulling up in what I would say these high-end SUVs, and in reality, they're just regular base SUVs. They're nothing fancy. But it was so much different than what I had grown
What
up
would your
with.
parents say?
Very
Because I would
shocking.
assume you'd go home sometimes and say, "Billy got this and Mike got this." How would your parents handle that?
You know, I was smart enough as a kid not to really try to rub that in. I grew up faster than I should have, and I realized the situation we were in, so I never did that. Actually, my senior year, I skipped my junior year and graduated high school at 16. But my senior year, in addition to taking my senior course load, I worked 45 hours a week so that I could pay for my expenses, and I would bring groceries home because things were, exceptionally bad that year. So I picked it up pretty early in life, and I don't know why, but I knew don't say those things. It's going to make your parents feel bad. And I had a great level of empathy as a child, and I didn't want to say that to my parents of, oh, they had this. I never really went that down that route, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, this reminds me too when you said when you first didn't know what you don't know, you it doesn't hurt you, and then all of a sudden you get exposed in middle school to, oh my God, this whole other world exists. And that reminds me of everything we deal with in today's day in social media. It's like you're sitting there in your life thinking that you, hey, my life's great. It might not even be anything special. And then all of a sudden, you go online, you start scrolling, and everyone else's lives look so much different and so much better. Oh my God, this person's here. This person's got a gold watch. This one's the, I mean, that comparison is the thief of joy, is something that we live in now 24/7.
I agree with that. And I've even been guilty of that a little bit myself because I'll post some cool travels. I have a little segment called Tommy's Travels. It's just a hashtag I throw on my LinkedIn post. But most of the stuff I've done, I didn't pay for. It was because I volunteered. And because I volunteered, I was invited. Because I introduced somebody and got a donation for somebody, I was invited. And I just done good things for other people. And so they wanted to do good things for me. But it was an act of me having to go out and work for it. I don't brag about it. It's cool. And usually when I'm showcasing something, it's look at this cool program, not look what I'm doing. But it is. People fake what they are in life. I try to bring that to my reality. I try to bring other people along. But it's, you got to take a step back and realize that that's a little Hollywood. That's a little HGTV, if you will.
There you
That
go.
they didn't get that. They didn't get to this spot overnight. And I had to suffer a lot to get to where I had to today. And I had to volunteer a lot to get to where I did today. There's always something behind the camera you're not seeing.
Oh, that 100%. 100%. Building success, a toolbox for coming out on top. You've talked about the book several times throughout, but tell us a little bit more exactly what you guys are talking about, the lessons you're teaching, and maybe the audience that should be consuming this.
Yeah, so it's definitely not a handyman book. This is not going to teach you how to change an outlet. So if that's what you're looking for, there's other books to look at. No, this is a little bit about my life story and how I kind of approach things differently. Most contractors don't engage PR firms to represent them. I wanted to come a better image. I wanted to get rid of that old grandpa image as a contractor that's going to yell at you. I wanted to get rid of that image. I wanted to say that you can be involved in the community, and being involved in the community pays back tenfold. It gives you a lot in your heart for what you've given, but it also makes you stand out as a better person, and it helps other people. I wanted to show in my book that this is all obtainable and you don't have to have $1 million to do this. I started off with nothing and I got to where I'm at today. I didn't have some magical family member that came and loaned me a $10 million to get my company started. This was literally step by step. Hell, in 2020 itself, I almost lost my company as so many other people did. And I have confided with those same people at the Tampa Club. I'll sit down and they're wearing much nicer clothes than I have. And I'll tell them about my story in 2020. And they're like, Tommy, we were the same way. We were wealthy and nothing. Not, we lost everything and we could barely feed ourselves. And so you realize that there's a lot of people out there. So I wanted to communicate those. Like you said, just because it's the nicest Rolex watch doesn't mean that they didn't suffer a lot before that point. That doesn't mean they didn't go through something. And the book kind of just talks about that in funny and whimsical ways, talking about little life lessons that I go along. And as far as who wants to read it, if you want to pick me up, if you want some fun, it's a little funny. It's a great demographic, especially for younger entrepreneurs or those entrepreneurs that are a little closer to our age that just aren't striking where they want to be. Oprah didn't start until 40. I'm almost 40. So it's kind of cool. Don't think that you have to be a Mark Zuckerberg starting at 20 something to be successful. You could be an Oprah starting at 40. You could be later. There's many, many countless stories of that. So
wait,
we just,
so Oprah Winfrey didn't start until 40?
Yeah, she. I encourage people to read her story, but if I remember it correctly, she got her first show, and it was just like B, C, less, D, less celebrities that she was kind of interviewing. And then I guess some people figured out she was Black and decided to give her a really, really crappy guest, because this was a time when it was still racial disparities was still happening. And she just slowly worked her way up. And now she is, you know, a juggernaut. She owns her own network. How many people own their own networks?
Yeah.
And she came from a life of poverty, raised by her grandmother, sexually abused, everything more traumatic than I went through. And look at where she's at today. So the point is Oprah's not so special. She did it. She got past it. And all of us can do that. All of us can do something special.
Yeah. Your story, hers, and many others who have come from tough experiences. I think that, and you could attest to this. I think that being raised in those environments and having these tough adversities, especially in childhood, really may shape you into a, if you let it, it could shape you into a completely driven and motivated person in your adult life. I would assume that that's you.
It is. I don't want to go back to where I was, but moreover than that, my initiatives in affordable housing and all the volunteer work that I do, I want to try to bring other kids out of what I was in. A good night's sleep is critical to school. It's critical to success. It's critical to breaking that poverty cycle. You can't always help the parents, but what if we can start helping the kids? Maybe we can help the parents and that's great, but let's at least start trying to help the kids. Let's start breaking this cycle now. Only because if I can prevent a kid from going through what I did, or a kid in the next generation, then that's worth it. That's worth it to me.
What was causing you? What was the trouble sleeping when you were coming up?
Parents arguing, yelling, you know, something's going on. You always hear about money issues. You always hear about, do we have money for food? Did you do this? Why did you lose that job? You know, there's lots of things like that would happen. And it would cause you to lose sleep. It did me. And then you worry about how you're being judged at school. Oh, I don't have the $100 Nikes like everybody else does. I have the Walmart sneakers. Oh, you go to Walmart for your sneakers? Yeah, I mean, that's shoes. Why else? I mean, where else do you go? Just those types of things, and being ignorant to your own poverty, and then becoming blissfully enlightened about it, that causes some issues.
Yes, no doubt. Building Success, we've linked it in the show notes. The book is coming out soon. You guys could order it there. Anywhere else you want people to find you, online, social, etc.?
TommyWhitehead.com is the best place to find all my socials. And I'm really, really heavy on LinkedIn. I love to reach out, connect, and talk to people. Book is available on June 1st. And we also have a very special announcement. May 31st through June 2nd, we're holding the Building Success Summit, which is a connector level event. It might involve yachts. It might involve an open bar. It might involve a Rocky Horror Picture Show. It might involve investor pitches. It's a lot of cool stuff. But you can find all that at TommyWhitehead.com.
Beautiful stuff. Yachts and open bar, man. That sounds extremely tempting.
Yeah, not a lot of that in Cleveland, huh?
No. not as much as you guys have, that's for sure. Although we do have a beautiful lake here. We do have some nice lake clubs, yacht clubs, but nothing compared to the sunny south, especially Florida, of course. Hey, man, wishing you continued building success, and great connecting with you.
Nate, it was all my pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today.